take them under the babies, and she, of course, she was glad to have somebody to take it too, because she wasn't too good on the snow. And took this baby, had it all wrapped up, its face all wrapped up and everything, and kind of held it up and put it over my shoulder. And, of course, the wind was blowing towards the head of the train. So when I stepped off and this baby over my shoulder, its face was right to the wind. Well, the shawl blew off of the little thing's face, and a man tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "Better take that baby down." He says, "It's lost its breath. That wind's blowing so hard that the baby's just black in the face when I took it down." Lord, boy, that scared me. But we got back to Cordova all right without a dead conductor, and I felt pretty good then. I never tried that kind of a stunt again, I'll tell you that. I think of all the crazy things I ever done in my long, varied, and somewhat dissipated career was on the Robeson River. It's about 200 miles to a trading post, and going in, I lost my tobacco, or part of it. I just had one carton, and that carton lasted me about a month, so I lost it in the river. Well, I went on, and the month got up, and I got my trap line all in nice shape, but I was out of tobacco. And boy, I was just nuts, no smoke, you know. So I said, "Well, the devil with it, I'll just go get me some." So I put on my snowshoes and I hightailed it out of there over the glacier and cleared down to Gulcana, got my tobacco and snowshoed back. And by the time I got back, why, I'd caught a lot of fur. But a wolverine had also got on my trap line. And it had just tore fur all up. I had one silver. And all there was left in the trap was the leg of the silver. Well, that was worth money them days. Well, I did finally follow the trail of the wolverine and found the silver. But it's tore up pretty bad. But I stitched it up and made a pretty good skin out of it. But it was just a mess, that trap line. When I got back into camp that night, I certainly was some disgusted. And you know, I just laid that tobacco up on the shelf, and I never did smoke it. I quit smoking for 4 years. I never touched it. And you know, it just didn't worry me a bit. I didn't want to smoke. I didn't care for a smoke. That's a funny thing. Now, if I'm 15 minutes without a smoke now, I'm all fuzzed out. But for that 4 years, I just didn't care whether I smoked or not. The fact is, I didn't crave it. I didn't want it. But then somebody sent me a carton of cigarettes from the States. I forget who it was. Probably a sister. I don't know. But I laid them up on the shelf, too. And one day I thought, well, now maybe I just will have a smoke. So I smoked one. Well, it didn't taste too good because I'd always smoked Bull Durham anyhow. And those are the tailor-made kind. And I smoked another one, and I just kept on till I smoked them up, then went down and got me a lot of Bull Durham and went smoking again, so I'm just not going to quit smoking any. Now, those Indians have a way of taking care of their health. You know, there's a lake they call Big Charlie Lake. Well, that lake is supposed to have a big fish in it. Oh, it's an awful big fish. Sometimes it'll break up through the ice, and you can see the ice swell up. A long time ago, his grandpapa, they was crossing that lake with what they call a stick canoe, a raft, and three caribou and five Indians. And they started to cross there. They got about halfway across, and that big fish come up, and he swallowed the whole bunch. Now, that might have been a, I don't know what, but something like that must have happened, or they wouldn't be scared to death in that lake. When those young Indians, they like to believe a white man's ways, and I was fishing on it. This young Indian was over there, and a big rock stuck out over it, and we was fishing for some trout, and he couldn't see his hook, and I could. And there was a great big lingcod. Them things will get to weigh them 50 pounds up there. Oh, they're awful big things. And I see this big lingcod coming. I never thought about the big fish in the lake. But I see this lingcod come up to take his bait, you know. And about the time the lingcod took hold of the bait, I said, "Big fish." And on the hook once and it didn't come, and so he just broke and run right back off the rock. He's afraid that fish would come right up over that rock and get him. But they come to that lake and fish for those lingcod. I don't know whether you've got them over in your country or not. They look like a catfish, only they're spotted, and they've got a long, slender tail. Well, in the spring and fall, there's just a little stream runs out of that big lake. Or you can step across it. Probably 3 foot wide and maybe a foot deep, 2 foot deep sometimes. Well, those lingcod will be in there just by the thousands. And all you got to do is just pick them out, that's all. I don't know what they're getting in there, grub of some kind, maybe spawn, I don't know. But they have the biggest liver you ever seen. One that'll weigh 10 pounds will have a liver in it as big as your fist. Well, that's cod liver oil, of course. Well, those fellas will make a trip over there and just feast on those livers. They'll catch the lingcod. They won't eat the lingcod at all. They don't want nothing to do with them. They won't eat them, just throw them away. Dogs can eat them if they want to, but they won't. But they'll get those liver out and they'll fry them. They'll sometimes roll them in flour and fry them. They're not bad. They're just pretty good eating, I'm telling you. But they'll just lay around there and feast on that cod liver oil or those lingcod livers and just get fat and greasy, I'm telling you. Well, about a medicine man. There was a medicine man we had in there on the Copper River. He called him Doc Pillum. He was a different Indian from any of them in there. There was a story that he come from someplace. Nobody knew where. He didn't even seem to know himself. But he looked more like a Cherokee, or he had that long nose, high forehead. He's a big man, and oh, a very deep voice. And they called him Doc Pillum. He was a medicine man, of course. And the first year we freighted up the Copper River, of course, now he didn't know a ton from a pound. Well, he knew what a pound was. He had no idea what a ton was. So I was coming up the river, and he come out and met me. He said, Slim, you going to freight up river this winter? I said, yeah. He said, Slim, you bring me a ton of tea. Well, they had given the old fella a stovepipe hat, high silk hat. I don't know where it come from. Somebody else had given him an old army jacket, and he had a pair of red woolen underwear. So when anybody'd come, he'd put on that red woolen underwear and his army coat and his plug hat, and boy, he was ready to accept company. But I never see this, but I knew about it. He was quite a medicine man. You know, now that gal that I told you that beat the medicine man that didn't die in her coffin, well, when she come out of that, if she'd have been a man, she'd have been a real medicine man. They doctor themselves. They talk to the spirit, and the spirit gets them well. And so that makes them quite a medicine man when they come out of anything like that. That old gal wasn't much, but yet they would go to her. Well, Doc Pillum, he was one of those smart guys, you know, and he got to be a pretty good medicine man. He wanted to be better, though. So he got sick one day, and he went to bed. A couple of days. They thought sure he's going to die, but he come out of it. And boy, then he was really a good medicine man. But still he wasn't satisfied, and he got sick again a year or two after that. And boy, he was awful sick. And he was unconscious for 4 or 5 days. Well, he had 2 women at that time. And when his younger wife was kind of worrying about him, I think. And him laying there unconscious, you know, she sneaked in on him. They wasn't supposed to go in there. But she sneaked in to see what's the matter and caught him up getting some grub and spilled it around camp so he didn't make much that time. It kind of spoiled him. He kind of tell about it himself and try to justify it, but he just couldn't do it, that's all. And you know, one time I took a Indian to show you how little they traveled those days. I took an Indian from Chestachina to Valdez. That's about 150 miles is all. Now, he'd never seen the coast. He'd never seen a steamboat. So while we was there, a steamboat come in. So I took him down on the wharf, and he would see the steamboat coming a couple of miles down. He turned around to me. He said, geez, that's a big stovepipe. Well, he didn't know what a boiler was. He just thought that was a stovepipe for keeping the thing warm. But anyhow, there was a Coast Indian there. So I said to him, I said, Adam, there's a Indian. And, yes, that's right, he's Indian. He looked like Indian. So he thought, I said, go over and talk to him, Adam. So he went over to talk to him. Pretty soon he come back, he said, I can't hear him. He meant he couldn't understand him. But just that 150 miles, that's just that much difference in the language, that he just, so they both, of course, had to talk English. He talked some English. So did the fellow on the coast. Dick, I don't know whether you ever seen any of those caribou runs or not, but I'll tell you, they're an interesting thing. You know, those in their rutting season, they'll leave way north of the Arctic Circle and start south and run clear to, oh, latitude 60, nothing uncommon. And they'll start maybe one or two or a dozen. Then they'll pick up momentum as they come. They travel about 10 miles an hour. And by the time they begin to get into the lower country, why, there's just tens of thousands of them. Now, of course, the old bulls will drop behind, and the calves will belong to the younger calves. That's just the way they have of getting away from interbreeding. Everything wild has a way of getting away from interbreeding. I think the beaver's the most unique, but those caribou, they'll just come by the thousands and tens of thousands. And they're kind of dangerous sometimes, too. You know, I got caught twice, in fact. I was coming through some timber, and I heard these caribou coming. Of course, they'd been stampeding. I was falling right on a trail. And it'd be through that brush, there may be 20 trails, maybe a quarter of a mile wide as they'd come through. And they'd just come through like the devil, you know. And I heard them coming behind me. I could hear their horns rattling and on the brush. And I said, gee, I guess better go up a tree. Well, tree is easy to climb there, spruce. And so I clumb this spruce just, oh, my height was all, that's all I needed. And those caribou come. Well, for a solid hour, I could reach down any minute and touch the caribou with my foot. They were just that thick and just on both sides, just thousands of them, I imagine, that had run over me if I'd have been there. They hadn't been up that tree. Another time I was on the Salina and I see a big herd coming over the mountains. It's way high in the mountains. Well, it's always interesting to watch those things, what they will do. So there wasn't a tree within 200 yards of it and never thought about a tree. It is open country, just a big river bar. Probably, half a mile wide. Anyhow, I was right in the middle of it. And some driftwood there, and I just sit down on the driftwood. Caribou come off the mountain. They come right straight towards me. And I got up, thought they'd run, but they didn't. I was a curiosity. And they just encircled me. And I'll bet they was 50 deep in a circle, not over 100 yards across. And them big bulls would paw the ground and shake their heads. And I shot into the air a couple of times. Didn't make a bit of difference. They didn't seem to worry him a bit. And I'll tell you, I was worried for a little while. But after a while, they took a notion to go on, and away they went. You know, they have really no leader. They're the only animal